Thank you. Day 18, hopefully the last day of the hearing. Paige, welcome to you this morning. Today's theme, we have a submission, the religious submission, so tell us how you'd like to proceed.
Well, I don't want to read my submission again, thank you. That's a great deal of your time and your intelligence. What I propose to do is that I propose to set the scene to group themes that concern Mr. May, and I'll do that very briefly in Oregon. I'm going to then invite Mr. Taylor to present his evidence. It is more lengthy than is customary for a summary of his evidence because of the way that the case panned out. When Mr. Taylor has finished, then I'll invite Craig to do a novel summary of his landscape evidence. Unusually, I'm going to suggest that Mr. Craig goes last because much of what Mr. Taylor has to say is really seamless in terms of the provisions which have now been produced by the Medley Bay trustee. So that's how we propose to present. We think we should comfortably fit within the 2 hour slot that we have. We caught up with Mr. Beresford and his team last night for a day watching rugby, and we expect that they'll be here at 11. So that's how we see the morning panning out.
Thank you. Thank you for assisting the organised, smooth organisation for you. in both aspects.
Yeah. Well, just to sort of set the scene for Mr. Taylor's evidence, there's really two broad themes that we are addressing. The first theme is in terms of the conceptual framework of the plan and the provisions in particular. And our main criticism of them is that they do not adhere to the top-down approach, which has always been inherent in the Act, but has more particularly come to the fore since King Salmon. The starting point has to be the agreed position of the landscape experts that we are dealing with an OML, and that having established that we are dealing with an OML, we must address the requirements of Section 6B and the provisions of Chapter 6 of the plan to understand what are the directive requirements of the Act in terms of responding to the OML policies. We say that there is a fundamental disconnect between the provisions of the proposed Lindu Bay zone and the requirements of Section 6 and Chapter 6. And Mr. Taylor is going to address those that disconnect. What I have submitted is that the provisions that you have been presented with have the flavour of a bottom-up drafting style. They have started with the rules that they want. They have drafted policies and objectives which could support those rules. But what they have not done is demonstrate how those policies and objectives of the zone flow from Chapter 6 and Chapter 3 of the plan and meet the directive requirements of Section 6B of the Act. If you are satisfied that our criticism of the provisions is fair, then that is fatal to the submission, and you need to engage with the detailed minutiae of how the rules work. The objectives and policies do not meet the direct requirements of Section 6B and do not align with Chapter 6 of the plan and what the rules say about it here and there. But you don't get to meet this until you've got objectives and policies that pass muster. Now, the second overarching thing that we wish to Charles, so before moving away from King Salman, you raised with my friend, Ms. Baker Galloway, whether environmental compensation is relevant to your analysis of the submission in the post-King Salman world. I set out in my legal submissions why I think it is not. There's a logical fallacy to the Endowed Trustees' positions insofar as they promote that the adverse effects of the consensus development form part of the existing environment. My suspicion is that that is correct, but strictly on the terms of the consent. But if that is correct, and if you accept that proposition, then also the positive effects that the court were relying on must also be treated as part of the existing environment. And so cannot now be advanced as a reason why the zone should be supported. You can't have both ways. You can't say the adverse effects are the existing environment, but we should accept the zone provisions because there's all these positive effects that really should come with it. No, it's all done.
Just stopping you here, what is in my mind, does that mean that you would support the suggestion I made to Council for the Liberty Bay Trustees, that if you're going to add something on top of the consent with its own adverse effect, they have to come up with new positive effects? Would that more than match the adverse effects that they're out?
Yes and no. I think the logic of that proposition. Because if you're going to be offsetting something new, you're going to have to be offset with something new. That seems logical to me. But I submit that you don't go there because that is no longer an appropriate approach to Section 16. Section 6B is the bottom line, and you cannot offset it with a positive effect. Because that's the overall rule of judgment approach, which King Salman has moved away from. And so, at page 4 of my written submissions, I set out an extensive quote from the Manifold Station case, in which the Court of Appeals quoted that their approach is no longer appropriate for consent. So, coming then to the second overarching theme of Mr. May's case, it poses the question, what is the end game here? What is the scope for? Mr. May's submission recorded his position that he accepts reluctantly the decision of the Environment Court and is determined to ensure that nothing beyond that decision is enabled by the zone. Now, the oral evidence of Mr. Darby on the 8th of June, taken on its face, would have him agree with that proposition. He told you that he didn't want anything more than what the Environment Court had granted. What he required was some unexplained flexibility in how he gets there. Now, Mr. Darby plainly overlooks the additional number of residential units that he was seeking. And he overlooks his own council's steadfast refusal to limit the scope of Glendon Bay Trustees' submission in the way set out in their own planning purposes provisions. So my submission to you is that there are only two conclusions to be drawn from Mr. Barber's oral evidence. Either he simply doesn't understand his own company's proposal, and it is much more extensive than what it enables than what he intends, or else he wasn't telling you the truth. But that, as Mr. Taylor would explain, the zoning provisions will enable much more extensive development with limited control compared to what the Environment Court had done. Now, my final submission in my written submissions was that in the post-King Salmon world, now that we understand that Section 16 must be treated as a bottom line, not something which must be factored into an overall rule of judgment, then the state trustees should be very grateful for the consent that they've got. Because my submission is that in the post-King Salmon world, such a consent may well have been not available to them. We should be treating it as the high watermark of what is achievable within that ground. So I think that is about as far as I want to take my oral submission this morning. I'm very happy to engage in whatever questions or discussions arise from him. But Mr.
Well, Mr. Hayes, the first thing I want to discuss with you is your proposition that if we accept your argument that the objectives and policies profit by this letter are fundamentally flawed, then the whole thing falls over in the next few years. As you will have observed, between Commissioner Hudson and I, by the time we had finished with Mr. Ferguson's permissions, there was not much that was left in one piece. And so the proposition I would ask your comments on is whether it is open to us to amend lock, stock and barrel, starting, as you observe, the objectives and policies are working down from there.
There's a whole bunch of things wrapped up in that. The first of which is their scope. I submit that there probably is, because your scope lies between rural zoning, which is what the plan goes by, and the form of zoning treatment, which is the subject of the submission. So I don't think there's a jurisdictional problem to you embarking upon some kind of rescue mission. My submission, there is a procedural fairness issue, though, because the ability of my client to meaningfully participate in the process is determined to a large extent by being able to engage with what the proposal actually is. So if you were to redraft the zone in a way that's actually lawful, we will inevitably arrive at provisions that my client has not had the opportunity to submit on.
Even if we take on board, no doubt, the contribution of Mr. Taylor and add that to our list of things that we need to address the redraft next month.
Well, yes, Mr. Taylor isn't going to be redrafting the provisions for you. He will certainly explain to you where to fix some of the more important problems are. But I don't think you're going to find yourself in a position where you can say, well, in light of the case of evidence, then this suite of provisions is going to achieve the purpose of the Act and Section 16 and not these ones.
Yes, I've heard you.
What effectively going to be suggesting to you is that the machinery provisions in the plan, which meet council's obligations under section 6B, are the ones found in chapter 6 and 21. And that is the appropriate suite for this problem.
In terms of the existing environment, is there another way we can look at it, which is that, putting aside the question of whether an environmental conservation approach is valid at all, I understand what you want to cover that. The environmental court decision represented the finding of fact as to where the balance of advantage and disadvantage lay.
Yes.
And that we might take that as our starting point, subject always to the legal issue, which you raise.
Yes.
Rather than treating it as a strict existing environment case, whereas which covers the whole assessment, that it's more that the environment court is part of the background in quantifying the nature of the positive effects and the nature of the adverse effects.
Well, I have given serious thought to making a ratio part of this commission, but decided not to do that because I don't think that it strictly is a ratio part issue. What I mean by that is to be bound by the alignment, because the context in which you're making the decisions is different. However, I do submit that you can find the court's decision very persuasive about what is necessary in order to get that proposal over the line. I mean, the language of finally balanced finds its way all through the environment court's decisions, and it took 2 years of coming and going between Parkins Bay Preserve as it was then, and the court, especially with one set of provisions that the court's prepared to sign off. And that's why I find extraordinary Mr. Darby's evidence where he suggests that, well, the conditions perhaps were more that important, and that some of the issues is more important than others. Well, Anderson was spent 2 years after that. Mr. Darby, did you hear what he was doing when he signed off? So to return to your point, is it legally binding on you? I suspect it probably isn't. You're dealing with a plan review rather than a resource consent. But the court's findings about section 6B and the extent to which litigation was required to satisfy section 6B is at least the high watermark in my submission. I suggest that post King Salmon, the court might have been less enamored with the environmental compensation approach than it was. But anything less than what the court imposed, I think, would certainly be implicitly unacceptable.
And in that regard, I understand where this may have come from, but there are aspects, not just again, as close to the there are aspects of which Wendy Bayard now suggested that Dr. Lee classified as positive features of the revised proposal, and I think you can hear of moving the LS area off the terrace over top of the bay, so it's all on the flat. That's one example. Is this all or nothing? In your view, there should be no changes. Should we not embark on inquiries to whether we can in fact do better?
You can do that, Mr. May isn't doing that because his position is that only what the court approved should be permitted. But if you take the view that there are aspects of the planning provisions which diminish the effects on the RML compared to what was granted, then there's no reason why you can't adopt that. Or as you say, ask yourself, can we do better? We haven't gone through the provisions, we haven't gone through the proposal to identify those things because we think there is so much more to be worried about. But conceptually, there's no limit upon your ability to say, well, the court may have done that, but we come to view in light of what's gone on since 2012 that a higher standard is required.
And the next question was logically following, I presume.
Yeah.
Or what the framework within which any advantages might be locked in.
Yes. Yes. It's enormously difficult to take one as a controlling regime and turn it into an enabling one. The designer, of course, permissive, whereas consent conditions are controllable. And tipping them on their head so that they behave in the same way is enormously difficult to do.
Fair comment, which is one of the reasons why I'm so Ferguson probably held through so many grass.
Yes.
And going to your quote from Man of War, the proposition I want to put to you that you highlighted in paragraph 33. Very little of that comment reflected the fact that this law had an RML in the coastal environment and therefore subject to the NZCT use policies that were fatal to King Salmon.
Well, Man of War was a case of that kind because being a Waiheke Island exercise, NZCTS was relevant. And we don't have that here, we're about as far from the coast as it's possible to be. But nevertheless, there is still a direct connection to Section 6B in terms of your obligations under that Section 64. So although we don't have the NZCTS interposing, we are still obliged to treat Section 6B as a directive provision.
And having reread King Man of War last night, the question here is, would we be on safer ground to rely on paragraph 61 of the decision and on the quote that you presented? And paragraph 61 is the one that starts with Section 16 and says the same thing applies to the coastal environment.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a reasonable proposition.
I'm not saying you don't get the same place, but.
Yes. So the particular passage in Section 30, paragraph 33 that I was interested in was the extent to which offsetting competing considerations was an acceptable approach to Section 16. And all of the parties in the matter were agreed that it was not about, which is the whole purpose of the appeal.
Inquiry as to whether some might be more important than others,
You can, yes. But the reason for my submission on that topic was the proposition advanced by Mr. Darby that some of the conditions were very important. And my submission, there is no warrant for that evidence, given the express terms of the submission itself. And each of the conditions had regulatory effect anyway. So that the Danish proposition to say that any regulatory instrument is more or less important than another part of the regulatory instrument.
I suppose the punchline is it might be, you might be very confident of that before saying that.
Yes. You want something to attach to that evidence to demonstrate the point. What's particularly ringing true about the importance of all of the conditions is the inherent staging that you find in the consent conditions, because it is clear that the court required of Park and Spade Preserve to get the golf course and the lion's share of the landscaping underway before the majority of the residential development was available to them. And the reason for that staging is explicitly recorded in the court's decision, that if they wanted there to be time for the revegetation to mature, to provide a mitigating effect. Now, I inferred from Mr. Darby's evidence that the flexibility that he is now seeking is the ability to do the residential first and get the vegetation in as part of that project. Presumably because that will assist the financial structuring of the project by getting money in sooner rather than later. Well, that consideration isn't a relevant one for you. You are concerned with the environmental issues.
Yes, thank you, sir. And in terms of the 8 extra houses, your discussion of a rigorous analysis.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but think, are you suggesting that we're not going to undertake a rigorous analysis before running the Derby Bay proposal, should we reach that conclusion?
Not at all. But the question that arose in my mind about that was, what is the framework of that rigorous analysis? When those covenants were drafted, there was no suggestion that the site was anything other than rural general, and that further residential development would have to be promoted by way of a resource consent in which the ONL provisions of the Rural General Zone and the Operative Plan were engaged. Now, if the additional 8 houses were to come forward under the policy framework as it's being proposed, in my submission, that does not compel the degree of rigor that either the Chapter 21 provisions in the proposed plan do, or the Chapter 9 provisions in the ultimate plan, which, to be frank, I suppose that's the whole point of this one, from being the data of these 4 years.
And maybe the next morning, so you might have this, I asked Mr. Ferguson what his, and by extension, Lindy Bay's view would be that the proposed zone was subzone of the rural zone, so that the provisions of chapter 21 and chapter 6 would continue to apply over the top of whatever was in the specific zone. With the tension with the idea that you're fully doing firmly in mind, and you said after reflection, but you didn't have a problem with that.
Yes. And I submit to you is that conceptually that's really the only way that this could proceed. Because once you accept the uncontested evidence that you're in an OAL, the chapter 6 provisions would direct you to a rural zoning form of treatment. The problem that I foresee from even dealing with it as a subzone of the rural zone is devising a compatible set of objectives and policies. Because the objectives and policies that have been proposed to you, in my opinion, are not consistent with the rural zone objectives and policies. None of the policies even mention the OAL, which is truly remarkable. So, yes, I think that it's going to proceed, it would have to be a sub-zone of the rural zone, but I still think we've got fundamental objectives and policy hurdles to overcome before that could be an acceptable solution.
Starting paragraph 7, the submission of Mr. May was lost in the premise that he only paid his own part of the submission that resulted in development of the outcomes that are different from those authorised by the existing resource consents granted by the Environment Court. I know that in the business of the panel, the Guardian of Darby also confirmed that clearly they are not seeking, other than the 8 additional residential sites, anything further than what they already did consent for. I accept that the existing resource consents provide consent based on environment for gas pressure submission of making assessment. However, I still consider that the revised proposals do not properly reflect the development approved by the Environment Court. While some areas have been approved, there still results in potential for an increased level of development under a policy framework that would be more enabling development at the expense of OAL values, such as the overriding provisions of section 16 of the RMA on here. In particular, my concerns relate to reduced OAL protection, potential development including distant accommodations in the open space farm area, particularly the area that was formerly referred to the area L,
just to know that it was clear as that,
the area out is the north facing slope adjacent to the Spiral Road, to the west of the dock reserve at that northern part of the revised process zone that was introduced to you last week. If you look at the, so the most 9 or 8 is another point of interest. This area was showing up in a completely different presentation from the whole area of this week that I was already in the group.
Thank you.
What I'm up against this week, get thrown into that on
oh, is the area around the lodge?
The area around the lodge, the lodge part in the original submission.
But it's just an L, there's nothing in it.
It's an L, something in it, there's one thing. The only area of Mr. Ferguson's revised RSS activity area, which doesn't have a covered roadway, is agrees that the DBC site is located in an OL. I note that the Smith's landscape venue has also now agreed to confirm the area over which the OL was originally thought to be uplifted cannot be separated from the overall OL. The particular OL is an inappropriate subdivision use and development. It's a fundamental matter of national importance under Section 6B of the RMA and is district-wide importance under both the offer of proposed district plans and the Otago Regional Policy Statement. The wording is that Section 6 is directed, requires the council shall recognise and provide the protection of the house. Given that the OL status of the land is essentially settled, it is necessary to consider whether the proposal that the area controls provide the necessary protection under Section 6B. My evidence in chief identified and discussed relevant objects and policies of the operative and proposed Otago Regional Policy Statement and Chapters 3, Section 21 of the proposed GLBC plan, which supported. I concluded that the policy framework of the PDP proposed plan was more strongly worded and leads to a greater requirement of possession of ODLs compared to the operative plan. In particular, I noted the wording of policy 6.3.1.3 that some versions of other proposals with an ODL will be assessed in case consistent matters in 2171 and 2172, which is the rural chapter, because subdivision and development is inappropriate in almost all locations, meaning successful applications will be exceptional cases. Assessment matter 21.7.1 then goes on to reassert that the critical activities are inappropriate in almost all cases within the zone. It's also considered in the context of the rural objects and policies in Chapter 21, and in particular Chapter 21.7.8, which I state here. That to avoid subdivision development areas that are identified through unsuitable development and associated policy 21.3.8.1 to assess subdivision development against the equivalent district wide chapters, particularly the objective compulsive for natural hazards and landscape chapters. Clear emphasis in the rural zone chapter on avoiding development in areas that are unsuitable through development, and it refers back to the landscape chapters in doing that. The revised provision is now proposed by Mr. Ferguson will result in an overall greater enabling focus for the GNZ station zone than revised by the Chapter 21 rural provisions. The sole objective in 44.3.1 is the provision of a tourism, residential and visitor accommodation and development set within a framework, and that framework seen described as rural open space, protecting and enhancing natural character and the outstanding natural landscapes, and providing biodiversity enhancement and recreational benefits. My reading of this objective is in the place of climate and development. The subject of that is referred to the climate framework within which they may be set, of which the ODI is but one of several matters. I consider that given the importance of sessions that feed, that this should be elevated to the prime objective of the provisions. With no reference to the ODI in any of the subsequent policies, there is general reference to landscape values and some policies, however these may be read in the context of the zone, and that several areas of those policies relate to, rather than the overarching ODI values. For example, policy 44.3.11 refers to policies of the Glenview Station, Glenview Bay and Parkin Bay landscape, rather than the broader ODI. In the context of the proposed GDC provisions, such policies would be taken to include the built environment and anticipated by the rules, rather than the wider ODI values. Fuel policies are of an amazing nature. In respect of residential development, policy 43110 may provide for residential and visitor accommodation within the farm homestead, lakeshore and residences activity areas, where the design, external appearance and location of buildings in these areas reflects the qualities of the landscape. With no reference to the ODI provisions, all section 16 required to protect the ODI from inappropriate development. There is only a requirement for design, external appearance and location to protect the qualities of the landscape, whatever that may mean. Similarly, policy 44.3.11 relating to commercial and visitor accommodation activities in the lakeshore activity area requires a high standard of building and landscaping to mitigate effects on visual amenities and natural character. There is no mention of ODI provisions for what visual amenities and natural character may or may not entail in this location. A like-like assessment would yield quite different results from an assessment matched for the landscape. This is repeated in other proposed policies, but do not seem to provide a blow-by-blow summary of the provisions. Rather, I consider that the proposed objective and policy framework for the zones is only enabling towards development and the extensive protection of what should be the overarching ODI values. I particularly concerned that responses to questions from the panel provided by Ms. Sweden, while she acknowledges her evidence of site located within the ODI, she also stated that once development is completed, it would be a case for removal of the site from the ODI on the basis that there were no longer certain ODI characteristics. I consider that this reinforces the proposals to not meet the suggestions that the requirements.
Mr. Taylor, what would worry the DRO get? The page notice submission would make the same observation. My recollection of that discussion that Commissioner Hudson had with Ms. Pfluger was that Ms. Pfluger's response was against the hypothetical where there was an avowal on the Glenview Bay side of the development, and she was saying that if the line had previously been to the east of the development area, post-development, you would logically move it to the west of the development area. I didn't understand her to be saying that it would no longer be cut out now. But maybe if you listen to the tape, page was sort of assiduously taken. That's also down the back, but you might have difficulty of that discussion, but just put that on the table.
Yes. Well, my recollection of that discussion is that Ms. Pfluger did indeed make the observation that you just mentioned about it would fit more naturally within the DRO, if there had been one. But my recollection of the discussion moved further than that subsequently about whether the development itself would put the site in a category in which its natural character wouldn't be the ODI description. So that's what my recollection of the discussion where it went, but obviously the tapes would be the final arbiter of that.
I think that what say it would be it would no longer be an RML but for the fact that it's too small.
Yes. That's my recollection also.
Well, thank you. Please carry on.
Right. I say you had a carry at 28. According to the visitor accommodation issue. I note that the revised proposal has the least provisions relating to a proposed lodge in Area L, as included in the original submission. Former Area L is located in the northern part of the alternative OSF at 30 area, as now proposed on suggestion on page 3 of supplementary evidence. In my unit, I describe it as being in a distinctive and completely separate landscape catchment from the remainder of the GDC development. It's directly facing Mount Aspiring Road and is highly visible from public areas on Mount Aspiring West Waco Road and the Diamond Lake Reserve and Walking Trees. It is also directly used as sites to build platforms for this amazing bus development. Whilst the revised proposal no longer will include the Area L, the policy and law framework is still highly enabling to support existing recommendations established in this area, such that it will be difficult to exercise control over any proposed development. My concerns with the effect of development in this area have not been reduced. Particularly, I know that policy 43.1.15 includes enabling small-scale eco-themed visitor accommodation within the OSF at 30 areas. Proposed rule 44.57 then makes visitor accommodation including buildings as discretionary activity in the OSF at 30 areas. Rule 44.510E specifically includes small-scale eco-themed visitor accommodation accommodation is not required. There is no building permit limit in the proposed land standard. The proposed rule 4469 would allow building height 8 inches for non-farm buildings in the area. Despite that, residential buildings in the area are. Mr. Burson has now also proposed a reduction in the size of the GSD, which includes an alternative reduced OSF activity area. This is accompanied by the identification of an open space protection area, overlay replacing the previous covenant protection area overlay, within which building would be a non-compliant activity under Rule 44.59. This has been defined on Mr. Burson by reference to the covenant areas included in the Environment Court's decision. It encompasses almost all of the alternative OSF activity area, with the only exception being former Area L. The exclusion of Area L from the open space protection area overlay arises simply because the area was not subject to previous covenants imposed by the Environment Court decision. The background for this is that the area was originally included as a proposed lodge site in the application before the Environment Court, and it was then reversed as covenant Area G. However, the lost proposals in Area D were withdrawn from the application prior to the Environment Court's decision, and no covenant conditions ever imposed over this area. The fact that the area was not covenanted in the court decision is not an ideal reflection of landscape areas, that no assessment of these is undertaken, nor does it constitute a basis for exclusion from the overlay area. The area had not been subject to any specific assessment of its suitability or otherwise for development in terms of use on the RML. In fact, the GDC evidence remains silent on any landscape assessment of this area for development, despite the court's decision according to the robust assessment of landscape effects would be required if any future development was failed. The implication of the framework now being proposed is that while visitor accommodation including buildings would be a discretionary activity in the RSF area, the former Area L is the only part of the attractive area in which visitor accommodation is not in compliant. As this is the only area excluded from the open space protection area overlay. The enabling statement containing the policies and rules that are excluded from the visitor accommodation development in this area, being the only ones not in compliance, and provide a strong direction of development than anticipated to occur. The proposed zone stands do not limit site coverage, they still have a book form through the 18-high buildings. I consider that the start of this payment would be almost impossible to resist significant build development occurring in this area. Discretionary activity status would imply that applicants consent are anticipated and appropriate in this area. This is quite the fact that the landscape evidence suggests that it does not address the effects of development on this land on the RML at all. This land is beyond the area subject to the original court approval, therefore I do not consider that its inclusion is necessary to recognise the existing consented environment. I have considered the evidence submitted addressing the inclusion of former area ballot in the ODC activity area and consequent exclusion from the open space protection area, in order to support the provision of the high order of establishment of visitor accommodation activities on this land. Area R. The control of buildings and activities in Area R are subject to two reception activity rules. Protocol 445 3C would make building within a home by open air control activity in the area subject to a range of controls and assessment factors. And controlled activities consent cannot be refused, and application will be considered on a non-notified basis with no appeal to parties. I also note that the maximum curtilage in building coverage for these home sites is proposed to be 1,000 square metres and 400 square metres respectively, whilst the maximum height is proposed at 4 metres above the strike down levels. I also note that Rule 4469K would provide for this to be increased to 6 metres as a restricted discretionary activity. This will result in an increased level of visual effect of built development that is significantly greater in effect on the RNL than that authorised by the Central Prison. I note that the original approved residences for the strike have been designed on geomorphic principles. The proposal is described by the applicant's architect and recorded in the court's decision as a generic outcome that is capable of being placed on the strike with only minor modification. The dwellings would be 3.6 metres high and by 750 to 300 square metres of floor space on a single level, but parallel. They will be partially sunk into the ground and their roofs will be covered in local grasses. Walls will be of natural concrete and windows that will be deeply recessed to limit clear. Garage and ventilation will be kept aware of the growing of the impact. The general purpose of the area will be between 900 and 1400 square metres, although a house might be 1952. The court in paragraph 257 of this decision then placed significant emphasis on these design elements and reaching conclusions as to the effects on the coherence of the ONL. Clear to me that although the specific house designs are not referenced in the approved conditions and consent documents, the home site plan and building areas, including levels R, that they do form part of the follow application, therefore are included in the scope of the overall consent, though are critical to the court's decision. The GDP proposes to part significantly from these design principles. Firstly, the building coverage for each resident will potentially increase by up to 60% above that of most consumers granted. The lack of specific design now means a variety of large buildings with differing built form materials will now occur. This potentially may include buildings up to 6 metres in height compared to the 3.6 metres originally proposed. Further 8 dwellings also proposed. I note that the supplementary evidence provided by this three provides some assessment of the visual impact of development. However, that assessment is limited. In particular, it only assesses visibility of buildings from locations on the White Mount Aspiring Road. It does not assess visibility from other public viewpoints, including the Lake Shore and surface area, walking track that runs around land and roads. These areas, which may all attract high levels of public access and recreational use, and where visibility of development is assessed. The spring gap is also not assessing the potential impact of large and higher buildings. I consider that part of this failing arises from 40 metres policies and assessment matters related to visibility for the effects on the RNL. Proposed policy 44.3.1b.y is to protect the qualities of the Glenview Station, Glenview Bay and Parkham Bay landscape from their visitors and appropriate subdivisions and matches developed by maintaining views of the site wind view from Lake Wanaka and maintaining views across the site wind view from the Wanaka Mountains Spiring Road. The policy is silent with the overall landscape turning to the greater area now, rather than discussing protecting qualities of three specific sub-areas within the zones. These qualities are not defined, however, given the range of policies concerning the native developments in the GST, would need to be in that context. This potentially places greater interest in protecting qualities attributed to the activity proposed in the zone, rather than protecting the area. Towards the one, the minimum consideration of the views on Lake Wanaka and the Wanaka Mount Aspiring Road. The only consensus out of the views rather than all the policies of Aspiring Road are now. This could be very narrow and specific, but also does not consider effects on the use of the locations. The land over which the stress is limited under Rule 44.5QA are then similarly constrained, control of the external appearance of buildings with respect to the effect on visual and landscape value of the area. There is no reference to the ONL, meaning that consideration would be limited to the immediate area of proposal only. Further assessment gap 2 would be limited to visibility of buildings from the Wanaka Mount Aspiring Road. There is no requirement to consider visibility from other areas. Indeed, restrictions on discretion would preclude this. I consider that the body might have publicly and privately accessible vehicles and thus can affect on the values we are now of their critical importance, as it is the court. In particular, the lake surface and foreshore areas and walking tracks are locations which attract highly as a recreational use, where people like to dwell for a long period of time and get persons passing the side of the road for a relatively fleeting period. For those reasons, I don't consider that the revised provisions and evidence adequately assess the potential effect of such a high level of development on the RNL. The second part of the activity rules dealing with area R is Rule 4454, which makes residential and visitor accommodation for restricted discretion activity subject to provision of spatial layout plan and revegetation strategy. The rule does not control buildings, they remain controlled by 4457, which was discussed above. The problem arises that although the law requires conversion of such plans, there is no robust mechanism to require such implementation. Given that buildings themselves are under controlled activities, they are able to be erected without a modification layout and re-education plans to be improved and implemented. Whilst the use of the building may require consent, it becomes difficult to enforce if the building is already there under the law. There are several effective to the rule, however, they lack the assistance from the vegetative cover and earthworks to grant site enhancement and remediation, as well as reducing the effects of certain buildings and structures. They all relate to the built environment rather than residential occupation for buildings themselves. Further, I note that the maps to be included in such plans only address screening the buildings from the road, they do not include other vehicles. I consider that the combination of controls and residential and visitor accommodation development in the area are sufficient. Potentially leads to significant development beyond that anticipated by the court, with such an adverse effect on the quality and value of the RNL. Section 5 of the original court decision included detailed requirements as to staging of the development, including critical earthworks and revegetation requirements, the provision of public good elements such as tracks and stadium and residential units. Condition 7 and 8 is to include specific requirements for completion and certification of certain earthworks and vegetation prior to construction of residential units. The GDP proposals do not include any comparable requirements for staging. I note that in answering panel questions, Mr. Darby advised that he did not consider staging as an important consideration for the court. However, the court did specifically discuss staging in respect to screening of buildings in its final decision, where it recorded that staging development deliberately related to the visibility of dwellings from cutting to earthquakes. I consider that retention of staging requirements to ensure that vegetation and earthquakes are established prior to the erection of buildings is essential to avoid adverse effects on development of the RNL. I also consider that it's the importance to ensure that provision of walking tracks and other public good elements offered by GDC that have a positive effect should also be subject to staging requirements. Otherwise, there would be no compulsion or mechanism for requirements to occur. I note that there are standards for construction of public access trails in Rule 44.1, but no actual rule requirement is provided by the RNL. Campground development. Proposed 4455 would provide for camping grounds in an area of GSP as a restricted discretion activity. There will also include visitor and establishment and operation of camping ground as listed activities in the activity area. There's no maximum site coverage or building area rule for the activity area. The camping ground is not formed part of the existing resource consent. I know that the evidence of Mr. Ferguson suggests traditional camping ground activities, besides seeing the intense caravans and version blocks for some cabins. And if you go on to state that more intense and built up forms of visitor accommodation such as a hotel or resort are anticipated. However, the definition of camping ground in the plan is tied to camping ground regulations 1985, which does not limit use in this way. That definition does not limit camping grounds to traditional tent and caravan sites, and cooking services to cover all types of visitor accommodation, including permanent most house and apartment units comprising significant buildings. It could also include semi-permanent accommodations such as trailer parks. I consider that these may give rise to greater visual effect than those anticipated by more traditional camping. The GSC activity area is highly visible for surrounding viewpoints, and I consider the potential effect of any such field development to be properly taken into account by GDT in their submissions and evidence. Other matters raised in my earlier evidence, maintenance of four faithful raised in under concern with respect to the original GDC submission, some of which have been partially agreed to amend the result of the prior proposals, and discuss this as following. Discuss my concerns with the area R above. My earlier evidence have also concerned the potential for additional development to be erected in the lack of specific spatial layout plan. In my opinion, the Eastern Centre would only be partially met by the provision of a homesite overlay plan, which restates the original 42 building platforms plus 8 new ones, and Rule 44.6.7, which would limit development to 50 residential or visitor accommodation units. It seems that this environment was a discretionary activity. My concern remains that discretionary activity space, in the context of the proposed GDP, objective policies and rule, sends the wrong message to users of the plan that additional development is acceptable, albeit through a consent process. The plan provides a rule that anticipates applications being made. This is quite different from a situation with resort consent, which includes conditions requiring covenants to prevent further development. I find it to be odd that the GDP states that only seek approval for the consent to be development. I am also concerned that once development proceeds, the new zone provisions, which are more enabling of development than the rural zones, will form a new environmental baseline against which future applications may be set, resulting in further erosion of the area values. This has already been signalled in responses to questions by Ms. Freeman, that once development occurs, it would be formed a basis for future uplift in the urban area of questions from the site, which is support. Area L, I have discussed my concerns with activity at Area L earlier in my supplementary units. Although GDT now proposed the removal of Area L from the proposed rules, my concerns is potential visitor accommodation in the northern placement part of the OEC area remain. I acknowledge that the revised proposal significantly reduces the number of applications that may be subject to non-notification under Rule 4.7.2. However, I may continue to acknowledge the status of the concern of non-notification for activities, including the range of buildings potentially subject to Rule 44.2, which includes the key residential activity area. I've discussed my concerns with control of our proposal in this area above, considering the results of significant departure from the built development that was being anticipated by resource consent conditions. Given that larger buildings are proposed with a potential wider range of style and material fields, I consider it important the ability to grant refuse consent and the discretion to require application and or identification of the parties to be available. My area evidence is critical of the original GBT submission and that not applying requirements for the re-education stretching of the area beyond that in the area art, including re-education proposals and other works including fencing and tracks in both areas. The amended provision now includes requirements for a strategy to include these matters in the area and Rule 44.5.4, which I discussed previously. However, this rule only relates to the use of residential and visitor accommodation for student buildings in activity area art. There is no apparent mechanism to require implementation of such plans and strategies or how it might apply to land outside the activity area, which may or may not be under control of property owners in the area art. I therefore have significant doubts as to the practicability and enforceability of such provisions. Once residential and visitor accommodation sites are established, subdivided and occupied, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to enforce revegetation requirements and effect the land over which new homeowners have no ownership or control. I acknowledge that the revised GDT position is that it no longer speaks to the extended area from over now. I do hear a remark that the revised proposal does now propose that this area of now change the next area to the area F to G. I would be concerned if this change would lead to additional building coverage in this area that is not in contemplated for assessment from a landscape perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. I think the panel should express our appreciation for you digging it in, so to speak, having got Mr. Ferguson's revised provisions last year. Would be in a position to give us such a detailed commentary today so that we can explore some aspects with you. And so, while I gave today the first leave of our week, if necessary, it's hugely appreciated that we have the ability to canvass these things with you. First of all, a question of fact. When we did our site visit, the representative of Garden Partners who showed us over the site. As was pointed out, Gabriel Glass to us while we were standing at the top of the residential area. I actually asked him where Mr. Darby's favourite neighbour was. So I know where it is, but how far is that in direct line of sight? principles from above the alley area or the from the irrigation area?
From the alley area, the closest house site near the bus development on the hill looks directly across the road to the area house. It would be well up from that side of the field. So the area L is probably around Glendale Bus. You've got the dock reserve on one side of the area L back and onto that. So top house right next to Maiden Island is pretty much directly opposite the boundary between the dock ramp and
CBC land. I see, it was Craig studying the
plan. Yeah, it's a photograph. Yeah, the,
like, I'm not saying, I've looked out for the last week or 15
years. No, I looked to be about 500 meters.
About 500 meters.
Yeah. It's like this last year. We've got the view, the distance between the two. They're 1 kilometer. It's about 500 meters. It's going to be 1 kilometer skewed. And that 500 meters.
That's probably resolution size?
From, yes, from one of the conversation sites.
So is there an edge site, do you mean on any more bus or on? Or on the GBC there?
On the GBC there.
Right. The residential site, the GBC there, it's probably about a K and a half on the east.
It's probably about 1 hour, okay.
The paragraph 61 of the evidence, no reading of those staging conditions is that they didn't prevent construction of the first two houses, they just prevented their occupation.
That's right.
They clearly did prevent construction of the other houses.
Yeah. And the first 10 houses are actually specified, which ones?
Yes, they're the last ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last in elevation. Clearly, you've identified a range of issues with the case you confronted, some of which I think members of the panel had already identified and discussed and dispersed them. But it occurred to me, and invite you to comment, that if it were redrafted on what we might call a neutral objectives and policy regime, that made anything other than what was already conceived in the non-combining activity. Would that pass muster in your view?
Yes, something which is more restricted than the current regime. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the rationale for that is if there is a rationale, we've come from standard submissions that we've effectively subsequent cases.
There is, I mean, given what Mr. Pace said to you about circumstances of the granting of the original consent and the fact that perhaps under the new case standard man of war regime that they're perhaps lucky to get what they want, and today things might have been different, you could look at the current consented development as being the absolute limit for that site, and that might give you perhaps a non-binding on that point. If we were just to take a strict approach on that one point, and apply this approach.
Because the reason I'm canvassing that, I've just written on my pad, I've just sort of checked this is a fair comment, I've written maybe. Is that fair?
No.
I've written a question that I posed for you, and I've paraphrased your answer as maybe.
Maybe, yes.
Is that fair?
I think there's definitely a stronger case now for my complaint to these matters to develop than what there would have been previously.
And the reason that I'm floating there is the possibility for that question. Page, that there are some elements of the revised proposal that the U.S. Congress suggests are actually beneficial. Beneficial in terms of the effects on the O&L.
Yes, there is. And I look at the objectives in chapter 6 of the O&L, and they talk about protecting, maintaining, and enhancing, like that in natural landscapes. So, to the degree that they may enhance the amount of O&L, that's certainly something that you should take into account. But enhancements shouldn't be at the expense of degradation or extraction of the areas.
Basically, no progress.
No. And I think you can treat the enhancements as consented to, and differently from future enhancements. So, that if enhancements as consented to are part of the system environment, and that is primary.
Just ask
a
few questions.
Speaking of Mr. Taylor, like the chair, I do appreciate the amount of work and thought that you put into producing and the wise statement which you helped us up. I can't imagine how many hours I put it over the weekend, but I imagine it was a few. I don't have any questions of you. Everything that you put in your statement does refer a correction to the draft provisions that we had in front of us that we received in the draft version, and so I made a couple of notes and I put up a couple of your points and cross-references from that to the third thing.
Two versions revised proposal, of course. There's the version that we produced with the supplementary this last week. But then there is this alternative OSF area with the additional rules which are recorded in the body of this evidence, but not in the revised set of provisions. And so I refer to it as needed by his further operations.
Yeah, so you've identified a couple of things that haven't been discussed with Mr. Booth, and I don't think it needs to be included. But I did want to just ask you about a couple of comments that you made in paragraph 36 and also in 70, where you talked about discretionary activity scope, and in paragraph 36, you said that the discretionary activity status would imply that applications for applications for consent are anticipated and appropriate in this area. I'd just like you to sort of explain what you mean by that, because in terms of a strict understanding of what the resource management provides for, there is something discretionary that is guaranteed as a consent that is forthcoming. I'd just like to hear you to explain why you consider that this would be opening the door to.
I mean, I suppose it goes back, you know, back to the old days of conditional uses, which are now discretionary activities. But it's
not
that
hard. You've got enough language,
the general assumption that identifying something that's made in that way is quite specific, that you're anticipating that case to be made. And it's on the merits, you can strip the technical objects of that application across the grounds and set it out. By definition, the act is discretionary activity that can be provided to the report and bank. So, by definition, the discretionary activity is something which a bank anticipates, and it anticipates that the proposed discretionary activities, by my discretionary activities, essentially the proposed are going to be able to be developed in accordance with the policies and the appropriate offer plan or the technical zone. So, well, there's still the ability to use it. In this case, the way it worded, because of this so descriptive way of what's supposed in that rule is an area in which that rule could apply is so small that it's almost as likely someone can apply in that area. The
question about that. I find your comments interesting because on the other hand you take another landscape actually getting evidence from different measures to do with ONR where they have been quite confident that there was sufficient rigor in the plan provisions relating to building platforms and mitigation of effects to buildings, but even under a restrictive positioning regime.
Depends on the policy framework behind it, because under the existing rules, in the rural zones, the whole developer's discretionary, of course, but it's going to be set in as a farmer, wherever it's set, rejects some policies in Chapter 6 and Chapter 21, and he says that it's in Chapter 21. That will apply in this case to this situation. So it's really not so much the data in the framework in which you can see the application which creates a problem. In this case, that framework is defined by the rules which are highly suggested for this recommendation of this area and the different policies which describe the small scale reshaping this recommendation as being in that area. So it would be very hard to give the existing policy framework to give this application to given that they are on the face of quite enabling and directed towards providing this sort of knowledge.
So what
you're saying
is that the policy framework.
The policy framework behind it rather than the space itself.
Right.
But I suppose building on from that is that the very inclusion of this piece of land within the OSF area where that rule applies isn't backed by any eventual assessment from GPC at all. It's the why it should or shouldn't be in that area where that provision was made in the first place. So no landscape assessment for you from any of your landscape officers about the discussion of the investment plan at all. But the question of whether or not it should even be in that zone would be probably in that particular area. Is it on the basis of what you see to be?
I wonder if I could just pick up on the point. The ODP, the cases which are similar to finalise the ODP actually discussed for the questions raised with you. And as I recall it, Judge Jackson, of course, said that in this particular location, discretionary activity was used in a particular sense that displaced the inputs that you identified, and that was the genesis of the provision that says anything that succeeds in one of those could be exceptional cases. Which has been carried forward into Chapter 6, but we have a lot more policy. And I have to note that there were numerous discussions opposing that particular policy. The punchline is this as simple as displacing the inputs by saying specifically that the DA status doesn't have that connotation in this case?
Yes, gently. For the alternatives of the agency policies for the site itself, then deal with the overarching objective of Chapter 6.
Or both.
We'll be part of Chapter 21 if we have the position we had, in which case so that's probably said that as we Chapter 21 would apply rather than the more enabling the site so we want to be proposing Chapter 44.
I don't really have anything further except a clarification on paragraph 14. The quote from the Environment Court decision that the dwelling will be 3.6 metres higher, 3.8.
Only 3.6. I mean, we called it in the discussion with Ms. Breeder last week, there was a discussion that it was 3.8 or 4. And I'll take it wasn't 4.
Well, in any case, something that I mentioned, that road on the natural road.
Okay, yeah,
but
Even under the existing rural traffic in rural zones, most of the developers are established. Of course, the dump is not going to have to come in at the same time or more. But that would be assessed under a more rigorous set of controls under the rural zone versus the not might exist with this. This opens it up a lot more to incrementally be worked right up. The house designs change, they're going to get higher, and then the whole environment changes and the scene will be set for the future. Right? So if the priests can't consider that situation, that would be based on quite different environments and what industry applications are considered.
And that would address your concern with, is it the area L? That's the, where that's your evidence is pointing out.
Yeah, well, it's quite noticeable that there, through all the iterations of these roles that we've seen, there's always this reference to this small thing. This is a recommendation development, which isn't really described anywhere, but if you look at the rule framework, could have just made something quite significant. In what is prime builder's life for me, but which we can see in the system.
And indeed, if you were looking at the suggestion of the potential campground area, there's a reasonable amount made of the fact that there was a campground really existing across the road, which is and there's a justification between that.
And now the other observation there is that there's no combination between Leisure Bay campground and what's been proposed here.
I did actually
see my papers last week, and whilst there might be policy differences in the system, that's about coordination between the facility
and one. Final question, when you were discussing the objectives and policies that were redrafted and you suggested they were stronger now than previously, I'm assuming that that was post-concern as opposed to the dissolution of anything that when you finished last season?
No, I think the wording of the new objectives and policies in Chapter 3, chapter 3, 1 years. The references to R&Rs and development of mutually inappropriate and only section of the house will see through is pretty strong word compared to what was in the old plan. I don't think that word was used previously. But it's seeing a real direction there. R&R is special and really nothing really spectacular to get contact with.
Yes, so in that regard you're referring to the ODP, operating district plan, supposed
to be.
Yeah. The policy was.
Sorry, rather than
the idea.
Yes.
Just while we're concerned there, I can further that the first part of the decision doesn't do so, 3.6 years.
No. Yes,
any more for you?
All good, thanks.
I think Sean was correct.
Thank you. So Mr. Craig, can you give a written summary as opposed to touch on the main theme of irony and course response to this? But my lead minister.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Trustees
since then.
Nice round statements.
yes, well, that's true. But none of those have given me cause to change my conclusions or observations that I've got in my ears. In large part, the most of the focus is on the conditions of the Western Sudan. Whereas, from what I understand, that the day crop is doing, the focus is on basically what I consider land use matters. So the most recent reiteration of chapter 44.3, the answer there is only seems to be focusing on the inevitable outcomes of development further to that which has already been conceived, as opposed to what the inevitable outcome is protection of the analysis. So with that in mind, I've keep my efforts firstly Mr. Page pointed out that the RNL of course sets out to achieve the direction of Section 16, that is protection of the outstanding natural benefit from inappropriate development change subdivision or use. Now, it's just a plan, and I understand that the provisions in the plan are subject to submission, although I also understand the RNL is beyond challenge now. Outlines quite a considerable list of provisions which are included in my appendix, one of my efforts. Now, not all of those are referred to refuge in the management of the RNL. Many of them refer to the management of the rural zones generally. It's my view that in considering those provisions, one excludes the other. In other words, if any activity occurs within the rural zones, whether it's RNL or not, where it's relevant in this case, needs to be considered. When I have a look at the plan, the first chapter, look at chapter 3 of the strategic directions, and in that chapter, ask that the board direct that the council identify the RNL, and as I've said, for this particular RNL, that the court feeds in part and is beyond challenge. The other consideration that the strategic directions are is that the prerequisite to the identification of our analysis of the degree of naturalness, or put in another way, the degree to which the land has been modified. Now, this benefit has been modified through farming practices, so it's not extremely natural. It is certainly considered to be sufficiently natural to attract RNL status. But in a way, that naturalness is a key prerequisite to whether the RNL is available or not. And it's an important consideration when considering the proposal put forth by the Integrated Trustees and implementing that proposal. Is clearly going to have a natural character of what we are now. In other words, it's going to modify that in any case. Then the other consideration that is emphasized not only in chapter 3 but also in chapter 6 and in chapter 21, cumulative effect. Now, the chapters are concerned with the cumulative effects specifically from the length of activity. Now the difficulty of course is, or the danger in considering human effects is that it's my experience that applicants might well argue, well, with development such as that proposal, you can see if it intermeshes in the form of the existing environment or the track of the existing environment, and on which basis may well justify human development, which may be the case if you consider the so now turning to chapter 6. As already mentioned, the contracts require direction consideration of any development in RML, they direct that consideration to Chapter 21, which is examined, and I'll come back to those shortly. And of course, it's my understanding that the affiliate consisting of payments heard, as you say, the kind of checklist to ensure that the relevant objectives and policies are being achieved or not, as may be. And as Mr. Taylor cited in his illness, the policy also states that inappropriate and all applications need to check for applications that will be additional changes. And I take it from that that the activity in the ONL would risk attract applying academic status. And that would depend on the existing subdivision of the Chapter 6 also identifies who might be affected by such a government. And very importantly, identifies those people who should be affected beyond the five counties. So, and that includes public and neighbours. In this case, it's made a neighbour to a particular site. And the public, of course, are those people who will have access to view of the site or appreciation of the site. And then the policy talk about or identify some of those bunch points. They put some emphasis on the road, but also recognise that the map of the unformed road that the public have access to. How often they might incorporate, for instance, walking tracks and such like. And there are further policies to identify other vantage points, and in this case, importantly, this would include the surface of Lake Wanaka, the recreational venue. And in my map, my first attachment to my map, 1 and page 3, I've identified those recognised the accessible vantage points for recreation areas. Among the affected parties, the South Primary expertise, recognition of the kind of power, they might hold that name as well. Now, these might as well extend beyond visual effects and appear to be important to cultural effects, subject to the definition of amenity in the RMA. The chapter also recognises that the RNL is a finite resource and that in particular the natural character that comprises these RNLs is finite, and therefore considerations to be given to what effect government might have on diminishing that particular finite character of that resource. And then the third policy, which is 3.2.5, addresses natural mitigation. Now, the policy is saying that mitigation itself could generate an adverse effect. So if you put it out in the screen, can't you, that might be contrary to the natural patterns that are occurring on a particular site. And as a result, that could be determined to be found to the network of that site and that is affecting its own right. And I noted from this blue agenda that she's included visual effect diagrams and also suggested data that the effect might be mitigated through the provision of earth mounting and vegetation. And to do that, may well, under that particular policy, result in effect. It's something that would have to be assessed or considered at a much broader level, of course, because understanding what the natural patterns are and whether these particular mitigation measures are sympathetic to those or contrary to those patterns. Yeah. Having said that, the policy is also recognised that farming is a component of the ONL. It goes on to say that while that may well continue, that such activity needs to be mindful of not derogating or adversely affecting the sheep of character that contributes to the ONL. And then the policies came down to the matter of biodiversity, natural vegetation, and while strictly speaking it's not necessarily a landscape matter, they do recognise that biodiversity and the presence of natural vegetation contributes to the political policy of the ONL. then turning to chapter 21, the assessment matters. Again, they stressed the exception of certain cases of exceptional cases. And fundamentally, they addressed four areas concerned. So, the first one, the effects on the landscape quality and character, and any development, therefore, or thereafter, is subject to what is referred to as preservation criteria. And that criteria is generally used throughout the country to assess ONLs generally. As I take this down to the next level, that part of the settlement process will be subsequent development that's proposed within an ONL. The second thing is consideration of visual amenity effects, and the assessment matters put considerable emphasis on the effects of views from vantage point outside of that passion site. And quite rightly, in the recognition that the appreciation of an ONL doesn't stop at site boundaries, that it's actually part of the public realm. Now, I should point out that while there are some emphasis on visual effects, the policy is also, and the system has considered landscape effects. Landscape effects are those that arise from changes in the landscape, irrespective of whether they are visible or not. In other words, people appreciate those changes that may occur in the landscape, even though they may not be able to see them. So, in the case of Kingsley Bay State trustee land, even though it might be possible to develop the land or increase further residential activity, so on, and do so in such a way that it's invisible, it still has results in a change, a fundamental change to the landscape that derogates from its natural character. Then the third area that the system matters focus on is the design and density of development. And again, they stress the effect of that from areas of vantage points beyond the boundary of the site. And finally, the cumulative effects. So it's good in my view that, in addition to what I said earlier about cumulative effects, that in this particular case, the consent of activity is, in my view, is something that should be implemented first before any consideration of the human effects of any subject like activity, and not much of monitor the effects of that intermediate activity or the conceded activity. From that, you can only, certain microbes can only really properly determine whether any accumulative effects threshold is likely to be breached in any way. The system matters also that consideration given to positive effects, and these positive effects would be, of course, remedial in terms of improving the landscape, and in particular the natural character of the landscape in any way, which in this case would involve revegetation and such like, notwithstanding that there is, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, there is evidence of some uncertainty as to exactly how that would be implemented and who would implement it. My understanding from what he's saying is owners of residences there are not obligated to do that. And then so that basically concludes my consideration of the district planning provisions. The other matter I was not very interested in the 6.2 identified report prepared by Dr. Mary Reed, and I agree with the report of the conclusions that she reaches from that. And she, of course, discussed in much more detail the implications of the environment court consent as well. So, in conclusion, the district plan certainly recognises the PR analogy as a very important landscape, and that the PRNLs generally throughout our district contribute. Or the appreciation is something that is acquired from points beyond the actual RNL itself, not depending on how people might appreciate it if they access within the RNL. Clearly the district plan and the proposed provision prefers developmental competition to occur outside the RNL. And if it doesn't then retain subject to restriction of valuation, subject to all of those relevant plan provisions that the objective policy in those chapters 3, 6 and 21. So that's good for reference.
Thank you. Great. Two questions for me. The first is that my recollection of the Stream 1 hearings is that visibility from tracks, walking tracks, was written out of those policies as an issue, presumably, to avoid discouraging matters from creating such tracks. Can you, as far as I'm back to that, since you specifically mentioned visibility from tracks as being a relevant district planning provision, can you assist me on that?
Yes. The road actually is the policy 631.11. I'll read it out here. It says, recognize the importance of protecting the landscape character and visual energy values, particularly as viewed from such places. So I'm assuming that if a walking track is accessible to the public, that policy would apply.
Might be in the detail of the definition for its public place.
Yeah, that's right. Because I understand some of these tracks are in private land. I think Sue also checked in the assessment matters 31.7.1.4a, that talks about the visual density values that the council shall certify that the extent to which the development is not feasible or will be reasonably difficult to see when viewed from public roads and other public roads.
Craig, the other thing that I foreshadowed in my question is that Parish and Taylor, Dr. Reed thought the proposed shifting of the VO's area to the lower level on the beach was a positive feature compared with the consented area for that development. So take these one by one, just to let them know whether you agree or disagree with Dr. Reed.
Well, the way I interpret that is that she is illustrating that principle whereby, and I stated in my evidence that especially if the government doesn't care, especially to have it properly rather than just finished throughout the landscape, or a co-located work where there are already life effects occurring. But I stated that with a qualification that any consideration of that needs to be done under the umbrella, the broader umbrella of all of the local conditions and provisions.
So presumably you would say the same thing about the other aspects,
yes.
which obviously we identified as possible for the broader.
Well, I agree that option two proposed doesn't include positive effects. That's to say that they have to look at it at the broader level. And secondly, it raises a little bit of an alarm bell with me, where there is a lot of, let's say, remedial activity that suggests that there is some tacit acknowledgement that the development is somewhat inappropriate. In other words, this is like it's a form of atonement. It's something that just has to be, let's say, always deferred back to the overall intent of the OML and how that is intended to achieve by the relevant provisions of Japan.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Also,
Mr. Craig. Have you given any thought to whether the considerable consent of developer for the new bay will, as I put in October, result in reconciliation of the OML and clarification?
No, because as the court pointed out, and as the Spurs pointed out, the urban area on which that contingent area has been located is too small an area to excise from the other now. I know that, of course, particularly mindful of that, when a landscape is affected, it's such a deep landscape, the whole landscape is much different than that.
Have you, was it part of your brief on behalf of the Minister, to look at the revised proposal incorporated into the zoning division 4 filing when the Denby Bay comes that includes such things as allowing the residential building to be higher than the original consensus? And for the other development, including the
transfer. Well, to the outset of my presentation, any further development really needs to assist against the provision of the plan.
It's not
in part of your brief. No, not at all. That's the next step, I'm sure.
All right,
I
don't have any more questions. Thank you very much.
Again, thank you, Mr. Craig, for indulging me with this process. You read Dr. Reed's evidence and just told us that you agree with it. There's one phrase that I'd like to add as a practical slogan. I comment on it. I feel quite easy to have if you first agree with it and second what you consider to be the thing of the phrase. If the degree of, and this is her 6.2 evidence, of the degree of liberalisation for future development of the proposed zoning provided is far and beyond, in my opinion, the ability of the reality of the vicinities of the zone. And then far and beyond the thing of the justice. And if you agree with that opinion, then what do you consider to be the greatest threat of her understanding of far beyond the ability of our
work with this? It's something that clearly has been identified as a lead question. Again, I would refer to the and the vision, as I understand that she does, to determine that. And that will take into account, as listed under the statutory mechanism, as consideration of the effects on humans and the impact of the effects of them.
Do you accept that view?
Sorry?
Do you accept that view?
Yeah.
Okay. That is.
These are all subject to that provider, school methods, the way that it was determined by consideration of the district and provisions. It's not predetermining a particular outcome of this sort. Thank you.
Any final thoughts, comments?
No, I think we've covered all of the material as completely as we can. I know your comments about the definition of public place and the extent of the form of tax within it. I don't think we need to worry too much about that in this particular submission because the viewpoints that concern Mr. Craig, Mr. Mayor, all. I mean, that would be public ones. We're not dealing with walking tracks that have been established over private land. So we're either dealing with roads, lakes, or that Diamond Lake, and I understand that not.
Thank you. We would like to open to you, so five PM 7 days hence. To provide any further comment, either by way of further evidence or submission, you will note that the words of my direction that were signed in of the essence.
Yes, I have to say that I don't anticipate taking advantage of that any present time. We would obviously have a debrief amongst ourselves at the conclusion of the session and full deal. So I think it's unlikely that it will be very concerned.
Yes, indeed. He's running a similar position in relation to Dunbar.
Ah, right. I wonder if he had been re-grasped back into this case.
No.
Alright. So we'll reserve our position, we'll see what they have to say.
Thank you very much. We'll take a 10 minutes adjournment. We start with the Barrister team, and I see that they've joined us. Yeah, keep on.